Welcome to the latest episode of Aerospace Radio Station Extended.
Well, it's a race to decarbonise, and that is a real motivator of all the staff here. So in order to achieve that target for decarbonised flight by 2050, certainly when it comes to other operators, then yes, it is a race. Yeah, we are operating in an environment when there really are only a handful of companies pursuing this technology.
Hello and welcome to Extended, your aerospace radio station.
Hello there, I'm Peter Johnson and welcome to the latest episode of Aerospace Radio Station Extended. Today I'm joined by Scott Pendry from Cranfield Aerospace. Scott, welcome back to Extended.
Thanks very much, Peter, and welcome to Cranfield.
Delighted to be out and about for once. Indeed, yeah. So thanks for having us today. We're going to talk about Cranfield in a short while. We're going to talk about the airfield and obviously some of the activities that you're undertaking here. But before we do anything, can you just tell us a little bit about yourself and your background and how you've got to this point?
Yes, absolutely. So I joined Cranfield Aerospace back in last September. Having previously spent 7 years with the Aerospace Technology Institute. And as you know, I'm also a council member of the Air League, which, of course, was our first interaction when I appeared on this podcast. Amazing to think it was over 10 years ago that we did that podcast. And also incredible to think what has happened in aerospace over the last 10 years or so. So here we are today with the subject being hydrogen fuel cells and decarbonisation. And indeed, if someone had said just, 4 years ago that we'd be talking about zero emissions aircraft powered by hydrogen fuel cells, you know, I think people would have laughed us out of the room.
Bonkers. The pressure on the industry, but on the world for carbon reduction has been so accelerated by recent issues. And we find ourselves as an industry facing those challenges and how we're going to overcome them. Now, I'm really excited to be here today to talk about where the sector is going and some of the innovative approaches that organisations like your good selves bring in. So tell us then more about Cranfield Aerospace and how that all fits together and what we're doing here today.
Well, we mentioned the environment, and that really is the core focus of our company. So we're developing a zero emissions hydrogen fuel cell powered aircraft. It's a multi-stage programme. And as part of the first phase of the project, the propulsion system of a Britten Norman Islander 9C aircraft will be converted from a conventional fossil fuel engine to a propulsion system comprised of an electric motor and hydrogen fuel cell system. And the fuel source is hydrogen gas. As I say, that it is a multi-stage project. We have four phases. The second stage will be looking at a larger aircraft, around about the 19-seat size. And then in subsequent stages, that's when it gets really exciting. That's when we're considering a new clean sheet design optimized around hydrogen. And that's something that actually that differentiates ourselves from some other organizations, companies playing in this space. We think that a retrofit solution will only get you so far. And to really be competitive in the long term, you need to produce a clean sheet design. And that's very exciting because that'll be the first whole aircraft manufactured in the UK for, as you know, quite some time.
Why are we here then in Cranfield? Why is Cranfield so important to the delivery of that objective?
So Cranfield Aerospace is a capability spin-out of Cranfield University. So we're a private company with the university as one of the shareholders.
Okay. That was quite an interesting point. It is an important point, though. You are a private organisation. You're not something spun off of a government department or have any ambitions like that. You are, in effect, a commercial business, but you do have particular funding streams and so forth. So can you just explain to us how that works?
Yes, of course. So Cranfield Aerospace itself was established over 30 years ago. Around about 2.5-3 years ago, the business had a change of direction. So prior to that, Cranfield had been carrying out bespoke and complex modifications for some of the world's largest OEMs. And I'll talk about that in a moment. Some really interesting projects. Indeed, when I formerly worked at the Aerospace Technology Institute, I would often come over here, have a look at the hangar, and I'd sort of joke and say, this is the UK Skunk Works, because there are so many cool things going on, some of which we can talk about, some of which we can't. Yeah. That's what makes it quite exciting. But the company reorientated its focus on hydrogen fuel cell technology and zero emissions aircraft 2.5 years ago for several reasons. One was we felt that in order to secure long-term growth, we were effectively beholden to the discretionary spend of companies like Airbus, Boeing, Rolls-Royce, etc., so that you couldn't plan for the long term. The second reason was, of course, the fact that aerospace at the moment is in a pivotal moment as we transition to zero, or rather net zero aviation by 2050. So everyone knows that we have to transition to more sustainable forms of flight. And we felt that because of our previous work with so many other OEMs doing very, very complex outsourced R&D projects, we felt that we had the strength and capabilities to do that. And that's fundamentally why we reorientated our approach. And it's very, very exciting. You're here in the management office, but of course the real heroes of this operation are over in our engineering office, around about 70 engineers at the moment, the majority of which are focused on zero emissions flight. And it's really quite inspiring when you head over to that office. You can see them crowded around their computers, looking at the CAD designs for the systems. And yeah, it's a very exciting place to work. I think when you include Cranfield University as well, you will not find a larger concentration of hydrogen aviation expertise in another location in the UK. So this really is a centre of excellence here. And we are blessed to have that relationship with the university. Obviously, we're a spin-out, as I've said, but we still maintain very, very close ties with the university for myriad reasons, really. And of course, Cranfield University is an airport as well. It's one of the rare facilities, rare universities that actually has its own airport and runway. Yeah.
And it's great to be here at an airfield as well to do this interview, because it makes it so much more relevant that this isn't just a project that's being done on screens and bits of paper. This is very practical, isn't it? You're looking to deliver a practical product.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. And let me tell you a little bit about Cranfield and the history of Cranfield itself. So the land was requisitioned by the Air Ministry in 1935. In 1937, the grass runway, the omnidirectional strip, was in operation. And then it was the winter of 1939 when the hard runways were laid down. Some of the aircraft that operated here, initially Hawker Hinds, and then Bow Fighters. It was used as a operational conversion unit for night fighters, and also the heavy maintenance of all of the RAF's bomber fleets. And from that came a lot of expertise in aeronautical technology. So it was in 1946 that the College of Aeronautics was established. And then in 1969, that name changed then to the Cranfield Institute of Technology. And that's when it became a formal university with degree awarding powers. And then in 1993, that was when it adopted the name Cranfield University. Some interesting types have been based here over the years, not least the BBMF's Lancaster, PA-474, which interestingly was actually used as a demonstrator aircraft for Handley Pages laminar flow wing, which is mounted vertically on the back of the aircraft.
Yeah, cool.
In addition, the Empire Test Pilot School was based here at Cranfield from 1945. I think it was 1945 to 1947. So you can imagine the types of aircraft that have been here before.
Avbeats heaven.
Indeed, yeah. And of course, the university. It's often said that there's NASA technology on any aircraft that you fly. I think you could say, quite conceivably, the very same for Cranfield. Because the university has been involved in research and development of so many different aircraft types, yeah, I'm sure there's a little piece of Cranfield somewhere. Some thinking has gone into the design or indeed manufacture of the aircraft flying today and of bygone years. So it's a very exciting and dynamic place to work.
And does that richness of history, for want of a better description, embed itself into the work you do? I mean, for me, driving up to any airfield automatically gives me a feeling and a sense of aviation and flight and excitement. Does that filter through some of the work you're doing, do you think?
Yes, it absolutely does. I often joke and say to people, this company, Cranfield Aerospace, is like a 30-year-old startup because, of course, we've had that reorientation focus. But crucially, we have over 30 years of experience, and that will help us significantly when it comes to actually certifying the first product, the Islander. So that is essential, really. We have a design organization and product organization approvals from the CAA, which makes us unique in that there are not many SMEs who have that capability in aerospace. So we have the heritage, but we also have the sort of thirst and desire, much like you'd find in a startup.
And I think that's what gives you the initiative here. I just want to, Scott, before we talk about some of the more modern developments going on, how does Cranfield Aerospace keep itself on that leading edge? How do you make sure that you're positioned to be developing some of these projects in an innovative way in an industry that, to be fair, has tapered off from an innovation perspective for a while? Yes, there's been efficiencies in engine and wing design and things like that, but there's been nothing significantly new, like a new fuel for a power plant, like we're going to talk about in a minute. Where do you get your people from? How do you keep yourself on that sort of leading edge?
Oh, that's a really good question. The people here are fantastic, very, very skilled engineers and technologists. We have got that capability because of our previous work. So, for example, I'll give you a few examples. We worked with Boeing and NASA on the X-48, so an X-plane. That was a dynamically scaled blended wing body aircraft. And as I say, dynamically scaled, so it would have to replicate the exact loads and inertia of the larger aircraft. So quite a complex R&D project. We also did some work for Airbus and Rolls-Royce very recently when they were converting an RJ-100, four engine aircraft to run on a hybrid electric propulsion system. So we were doing some of the integration work for the gas turbine inside the fuselage. Again, we've worked with Rolls-Royce on the recent Spirit of Innovation aircraft, which, as you know, broke the record for the fastest electric aircraft.
Yeah.
And we've also worked with Rolls-Royce on an eVTOL platform. So that's when we designed and built a full-scale mock-up of an electric vertical takeoff and landing aircraft. So picture, a kind of air taxi concept that you'll have probably seen in the press. So we did some work for them there, looking at how we mounted that aircraft, mock-up aircraft, on a fire truck so it could go up and down the runway at very high speed.
Yeah.
And that would simulate what would happen, how the aircraft responds to the transition from horizontal to vertical flight, which is, of course, crucial for the development of those electric vertical takeoff and landing aircraft. So it's those set of references that have provided the engineering team with a unique set of capabilities. And that's why we feel very confident that we can apply that skill, those skills and competencies to what we're trying to achieve now with hydrogen fuel cell technology.
Okay. So let's go on to talk about that technology. Why hydrogen? Why not some sort of biofuel or something else that would fit into a more traditional power plant?
Yeah, well, there's a very simple answer to that, and it's fundamentally hydrogen does not produce any emissions, certainly when you're using it in a fuel cell format. So initially we did consider the use of batteries, but again, it's very simple there. They just do not have the energy density that is required for long, well, not long, but certainly the kind of ranges that you would want to see on sub-regional or regional aircraft. Right. So we believe that they are only of use for smaller scale applications. So the eVTOL aircraft that I mentioned. So the kind of air taxi operations, the companies like Lilium, Joby, Archer, Vertical Aerospace, all of those companies are using batteries.
Right, okay.
Yeah, so there are two types of sustainable aviation fuels. You mentioned biofuels there. And those are, of course, derived from feedstocks, initially from biomass, so crops, agricultural residues, or other organic matter. The other route is so-called power-to-liquid SAFs. So only power-to-liquid SAF has the potential to scale to address aviation demand. So power-to-liquid SAFs, or electrofuels, or e-fuels, or synthetic fuels, the very fact that there isn't a simple name for them gives you an indication at how we're in the infancy of the technology here. But fundamentally, those fuels are made from captured carbon. That's either through atmospheric or industrial gases, combined with electrically produced hydrogen from splitting water into hydrogen and oxygen. And then, of course, you combine the hydrogen with the carbon to produce the fuel, which then can be burned. So it's not a zero carbon solution. It's a net zero solution. That's a crucial point.
Right. Okay.
That the carbon is still going back into the atmosphere.
Yeah.
So with hydrogen, we believe that is suitable for smaller aircraft.
Right.
The fundamental issue with hydrogen is that it's while it's lighter than kerosene, it's a lot larger. So there are only,
in terms of mass.
Yeah.
Sorry, I'm not an engineer, so I'm just trying to get my head around. What.
In terms of the size it takes, So okay. it's a volumetric. It's a lot larger, basically. Yeah. So when it's stored as a gas, it's 7 times as big as kerosene.
Wow.
And when it's cryogenically cooled, it is 4 times as big. So there are some inherent limitations to it. As you go up to larger aircraft, when you think about the drag of tanks, etc., even if there is a new airframe that's optimized around it, there's only so far you can take the technology.
Yeah,
which is why we think it's well suited to the smaller aircraft, sub-regional or regional. So the Islander, like we'll see today. Up to possibly an ATR-42 kind of size, Dash 8 Q400, that kind of size. Anything bigger than it becomes a bit more problematic. That said, of course, Airbus are doing a lot of great work on that, and it's really pleasing to see that. So it does have some limitation.
So one other question then on hydrogen, how about supply? Because that brings its own challenges as well. Now, I know we're not talking about how you make hydrogen and the facilities there, but is there going to be a restriction in the future on capability or field capability to supply enough hydrogen for products like this?
Yeah, so we're actually very optimistic about that. So all the forecasts and market research that we've done ourselves indicates that actually the supply will increase quite rapidly, because we're looking at a in the future, with the increase in renewable power, those renewables will power the electrolyzers that will convert the water into its constituent parts of hydrogen and oxygen.
Okay.
So we believe that the future is looking very, very good for hydrogen.
Okay.
It's certainly not the silver bullet. And you do find many people kind of say there is a bit of hydrogen hype at the moment.
Yeah.
We are an aerospace firm. We're actually technology agnostic. this is a suitable way of decarbonizing flight. You know, we are not hydrogen evangelists. Yeah. But as I say, all of the research that we've done show that the price will come significantly down. And if you think about it, you know, it's only one stage of the process to make a sustainable aviation fuel. Because, of course, with that, you need to add the carbon using carbon capture technology, which makes it a more sort of complex solution to answering the aviation decarbonization challenge.
Yeah. And how receptive is the industry to this change? Because this is a significant change. I mean, you know, go to any airport and, you know, they're all piped in with all their kerosene, JP45 and all sorts of other things. This is making them face a very, very different challenge. How receptive is the wider industry to this technology?
It is a challenge, but overall, I think the reception is very good. And that's in part owing to the last few years. A lot of different organizations have basically said hydrogen is a viable, not only technologically viable, but also commercially viable.
Right.
So thanks in large part, actually, I should reference the Aerospace Technology Institute's Fly Zero study, which concluded basically that hydrogen is a viable option.
Right.
I mean, that was a year-long feasibility study into this technology that was conducted at the very height of the pandemic, with experts from all around the UK seconded in from Airbus, Rolls-Royce, Collins, Spirit, Meggitt, etc. And that was a very, very comprehensive study.
Okay.
In addition, you look across the water to our colleagues in Europe, and there is a huge focus on the potential for hydrogen in aviation. Less so, though, interestingly, in the US.
Okay. Well, not unsurprisingly, maybe, but...
Although, interestingly, of course, we do have ongoing discussions with several operators based in the US, existing operators of the Britain Norman Islander.
Yeah, before we go down and look at the work that's going on to convert that airframe, can you give us a simple description on how a hydrogen-powered engine works? You know, I'm not an engineer. There might be some engineers listening, but I've no idea. Are we simply replacing a fuel supply with a different igniter, or is this how complex is this technology we're going to look at?
So basically, fuel cells directly convert hydrogen to electricity via a chemical process. The hydrogen reacts with oxygen across an electrochemical fuel cell, very similar to that of a battery, to produce electricity, as well as water and small amounts of heat. The electricity powers the propeller motors, and that leaves only water and heat as a byproduct. So heat exchangers are required to ensure that the fuel cell system maintains its optimum temperature. And that, as we'll see on the aircraft, is quite a large element of it. So in order to keep those fuel cells operating at their optimum temperature, we are working with the company, you might have heard of them, Reaction Engines.
Yeah.
So they're providing the thermal management system.
Okay.
We're delighted with that partnership. We've got many, many partners on this program, but that we're particularly proud of that because all of our technology will be on the outside of the aircraft. And that's crucial, obviously, if you've got the fuel cell system or the heat management system on the inside in the cabin.
Yeah.
And then that's reducing the space quite significantly for the passengers.
Yeah.
So what our engineers have developed, the actual fuel cell system looks exactly like the nacelle of a conventional engine.
Right.
But it's really quite remarkable how tightly packed the technology is in that nacelle. So it doesn't look largely different, apart from the large air intake. That will be the main noticeable difference. And of course, the fuel tanks themselves, which essentially look like drop tanks that you'd find on a fighter.
Two other questions then, just before we go out and have a look at this. The first question is, how receptive is the public to hydrogen power? It's not something I've ever thought of, really.
Yes, it's something that I know the government are doing lots of surveys and consultations of. I think it should be fine, because I don't think there'll be much of a difference in the operation of the aircraft.
Right.
Certainly with the retrofit designs first, the aircraft are going to look exactly the same, apart from, as I say, those notable features like the fuel tank, the hydrogen gas tank. So overall, we've had no major concerns or queries. Naturally, there is that question that pops up. Oh, isn't this a highly flammable fuel source?
Sure.
But then, so is kerosene.
Yeah.
And arguably, you can make the argument that one is as bad as the other. Ultimately, you're dealing with fuels that will combust.
Sure. Is this a race to produce the first hydrogen powered aircraft? Obviously, you've seen other news, particularly recently, about other innovations in hydrogen. How much pressure do you folks feel about the speed at which the whole sector is moving?
Well, it's a race to decarbonize, and that is a real motivator of all the staff here. So in order to achieve that target for decarbonized flight by 2050, it is a race. As you know, aircraft development programs are very, very long and expensive. Certainly when it comes to other operators, then yes, it is a race. Yeah. I mean, we are attracting investment from several interesting investors, but so too are others.
Yeah, sure.
So it is a race for investment. We are operating in an environment when there really are only a handful of companies pursuing this technology. And to a certain extent, we do collaborate. So when you think about regulation and policy, we will collaborate to think about the airport infrastructure, the whole environment, the operating environment. So it's not just about competing, it's also about collaborating with other companies as well.
Okay. And one other question I forgot to ask about Cranfield Aerospace, actually. Just looking through recent news items over the last few months, interest from international airlines. There's interest in cargo. I noticed, I think it was just yesterday on social media, you had MPs visiting you. How is all this excitement feeling? Do you feel that there is a strong drive behind the sector to make this happen? Or do you feel a bit isolated in trying to make this happen in a bit of an island?
No, we don't feel isolated. And that would be an incredibly tough period to be in. But there is the real sense of urgency to decarbonize. We all want to continue enjoying flying.
Yeah.
And while these are, we're focused on smaller aircraft, this is ultimately a building block. The technology can be applied to much larger aircraft in the future.
And another question, just before we leave the lovely warm confines of this office, how's this thing going to sound?
I think it's very well known that the Britain Norman Islander isn't the quietest of aircraft.
No,
but with the propulsion system, it will be quieter. We're also moving to a three-bladed prop as well, which will be optimized for the fuel, for the electric motors. So it will be a lot quieter than what people are used to.
All right. Okay. Well, that makes me feel better. At least we'll still be able to hear it.
Did you know that in the late 1940s? During atomic weapons testing in the Pacific, the USA used Boeing B-17 Flying Fortresses as unmanned radio-controlled drones. Did you also know that in 1927, two RAF officers in a Hawker Horsley set a new distance record, flying from Britain to the Persian Gulf, only for it to be eclipsed just hours later by Charles Lindbergh's Solo Atlantic crossing, which was a mere 180 miles longer? If your answers to the above are yes, you're probably a regular reader of The Aviation Historian, the quarterly journal, print and digital, that explores the less well-trodden paths of flying history. If your answers are no, visit theaviationhistorian.com and see what you're missing.
From across the globe, from the centre of aerospace, and now to you.
The Royal Aeronautical Society is the world's only professional body dedicated to the entire aerospace community. Established in 1866 to further the art, science and engineering of aeronautics, the Society has remained at the forefront of developments in aerospace. Visit www.aerosociety.com.
In this next part of the interview, we're in a working hangar. It's very noisy, there's lots of aircraft noise going on, and there are people working in the background, so I hope this doesn't ruin your listen.
So, Scott, we've come down to the hangar. There are a number of aircraft in here. I've got to say I'm a little surprised by some of them. Can you just explain what I'm looking at before we talk about the Islander and the topics we talked about in the office?
Yeah, by all means. So we didn't mention earlier that we actually run an MRO facility here at Cranfield. So we're surrounded by some of our principal clients' aircraft. So that's L3 Harris Flight Training. So we do all the maintenance for them. And that's we've retained that capability to have that strategic ability to actually service and repair new aircraft powered by hydrogen. So that's why we want to retain that capability. The aircraft that you see in the background is the BA-146 prototype. Yep. So that was built in 1980. And then it was developed into the BA-146-300 standard in 1987. And that aircraft is operated by the facility for airborne atmospheric measurements. So it's a world-class research aircraft that has a number of scientific instruments on the exterior of the aircraft, as well as an enhanced fuel system to allow it to do further longer-range missions. And it was us, Cranfield Aerospace, that did those complex modifications to that particular aircraft. So that aircraft is a piece of aviation history in itself, being the original BA-146 prototype aircraft.
Right, I didn't expect to see a 146 in the hangar, so that's nice. So I'll have to have a wander and look at that. What else have we got in the hangar here?
So the aircraft in front of us is the demonstrator aircraft that we'll be converting to run on a hydrogen fuel cell system. So it is a Britain Norman Islander. And interestingly, this very aircraft has a quite a funny history, in that this was the aircraft that was used in the James Bond film Spectre. Ah. So if you recall, there was quite a good scene where James Bond is trying to... I can't remember exactly. I think he's in the Austrian Alps trying to hunt down some yep. villains. And, of course, he suddenly appears in a black Islander, chases them through the snow, does some extremely cool manoeuvres in the aircraft. And the aircraft that was used for that stunt is this very aircraft.
Wow. Okay.
And, of course, now it's being given a new lease of life as a hydrogen demonstrator aircraft.
Okay.
So something to tell you about the aircraft. We've obviously talked about the hydrogen fuel cell system back in the office. So you'll have to sort of look at the wing and imagine that there's a very large fuel tank underneath storing all of that hydrogen. Now, we talked about the hydrogen. It has some limitations, but the important thing to remember about this aircraft is that most of its operation, indeed over 80% of the operation of Islanders today, are of flights less than 60 minutes.
Okay.
So this aircraft, when we finished with it, and it will be running on hydrogen, will have an endurance of 60 minutes plus the standard 45 minutes reserve. So it will be well suited to the majority of routes that operators use for it right now.
Right. So initially, the aircraft will have one engine or one power plant run by hydrogen, but the intention is eventually for both power plants to operate that way?
Yes, that's right. Exactly right. By doing one side first, it de-risks the whole program. If we encounter any problems, we can, of course, iterate before we move on to a double-sided hydrogen demonstrator, which is, as you know, quite standard for the aerospace industry to test something on one side first before doing a complete test.
Okay. And as you said, this is an active airframe, isn't it? So, you know, this aircraft is expected to fly as it used to. There's no other modifications other than the power and fuel supply.
Exactly that. The only other thing to mention is that there will be a modified human-machine interface in the form of a complete new instrumentation set in the cockpit.
Right.
So providing the pilot with slightly different details that you wouldn't normally get if you're flying a conventional aircraft. So you're looking at the system, the battery system, how much power is available. Just some key nuances that the pilot will have to take notice of.
Yeah. And what's the program for developing this aircraft, converting it, and hopefully getting it to fly. What are we looking at in terms of timescales?
So in the next couple of months, that's when we'll begin the rig test, so assembling all the systems outside of the aircraft, testing them on an Ironbird rig. Then we will begin the integration process, and then we're looking to fly back end of this year.
Right.
Then we take the learnings from that, do a series of demonstration flights before certifying the initial aircraft for passenger flights in 2026. But as I said before, this is, while it's a viable product in its own right, it is a means to an end, because what we've embarked on is a multi-stage project.
Yeah.
So looking at the next stage being a larger 19-seat aircraft, and then potentially an even larger retrofit, or indeed a clean sheet design. And that's where we'd work with, it won't surprise you to learn that Cranfield Aerospace has very good relationships with lots of different aerospace companies in the UK. We'd be looking to partner at that point.
Right, okay. So in terms of this carrying passengers, in effect is a test bed to a higher platform. Are any customers showing interest in placing orders for equipment at the moment that's powered by hydrogen?
Yes, we've quite a large number now of letters of intent for the hydrogen fuel cell conversion kits. And conversations are beginning around orders. What's been quite an interesting development of late is that we've been selected by Air New Zealand to join their basically their decarbonisation program, and we're the only supplier of hydrogen based aircraft. So that is a real vote of confidence in what we're trying to achieve here.
Okay.
So to conclude, we have over 80 letters of intent for hydrogen fuel cell kits. Some other recent news is our partnership with the company called Dronamics, who are producing a cargo drone. That's actually quite long range. Now, they've expressed a real interest in using the technology that we're developing, i.e. a hydrogen fuel cell system, to power that drone. And that, hopefully, will lead to many orders.
Right.
So expect some further news on that in the coming weeks, right. But we're very excited about that.
So just on Air New Zealand, they fly Q400s, would they be looking to convert those, or would they be looking to put power onto some other airframe?
Certainly in the long term, yes, they are looking to convert all of their existing regional fleet to zero emissions.
Right.
But in the short term, you know, they may even consider newer routes focused on smaller aircraft with reduced range, purely because they know they can get the zero emissions technology from aircraft like ours.
Right. Come back to then our Islander. We talked about the type of aircraft and how it fits the scope of the hydrogen power cells that you're looking for. What's the relationship with Britten Norman?
So we work hand in glove with Britten Norman, who are a partner on this particular program, and that has enabled us to learn a great deal about the aircraft and its potential. And indeed, you know, there is a possibility of increasing the number of Islanders produced here in the UK purely because of this program.
Right. Okay. Interesting that again, just coming back to the whole Cranfield environment, we sit in a hangar with a 146. Is there any intention to look at another aircraft than the Islander for this particular product? I know you talked about a larger aircraft at some time, but would this be something that could be retrofitted to other aircraft types?
Yes, indeed. So, yes, in short, we are looking actively now at the next stage. So considering what platform that would be. It's important to point out that the supplemental type certificate is when you're looking at adding this fuel system to a new aircraft, you have to look at the aircraft level. It's not the kind of product, you can't just bolt on a hydrogen fuel cell system to any aircraft. So you have to think about the integration at an aircraft level.
So Scott, looking at this Islander and some of the engineering, and there's lots of pipes, tubes and bits and pieces around that. It's complex engineering. We talked about some of the design engineering challenges in the office.
Yes.
But with sustainability and the future so much more now in the hands of younger people and looking to get a much more diverse group involved in aviation. Is this a platform to help organisations like you do that?
Yes, it is. And we certainly find that there's a lot of interest purely because of that race to sustainability. We often find that, younger people, and we do have quite a young workforce of some very good young engineers, they are extremely motivated by that challenge, by the challenge of trying to well, as you said, you know, it is a race to net zero
emissions. It's their
emissions.
Future, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. So, yeah, we find it, you know, it's very encouraging, the number of people who are coming to us who actually want to work on a solution to climate change. And that's a very powerful motivator.
And can Cranfield Aerospace play a role in the future of bringing younger and a more diverse workforce into the sector? You know, more women engineers, younger engineers, diverse and ethnic groups. Do you feel that you've got a role in playing that in the future? Do you think that's something that you can support?
Absolutely, because we have to attract the most diverse talent. It doesn't matter where someone's from or, you know, what they've done before. We need the expertise, and you can only find that by having a genuinely diverse approach to recruitment.
Yeah.
So yes, we do. If you look in our engineering office, you'll find people from all around the world, from all kinds of different backgrounds, and that makes it quite a fun and exciting place to work.
Yeah. Okay. We've talked about the aircraft. We talked about the next stages after that. As we were walking down to the hangar, you showed me a building that hopefully is going to be your future working environment. What next for Cranfield Aerospace?
Next is, we will shortly move into that refurbished hangar that I showed you earlier. And next is just it's a story of growth. And, you know, touch wood, things have been going well so far, and we'll continue to get the investment required to convert what we see now, an R&D project, into a viable commercial product. But as I say, we've got some significant letters of intent. We've got some great relationships with customers, and those conversations are just snowballing. So it's looking good.
Excellent. So coming back to some of the basics, where can we find out about Cranfield Aerospace? Are you on social media, website?
Yes, we are. Yeah, we're on Twitter and LinkedIn with the address being CAES_UK and Cranfield Aerospace Solutions on LinkedIn.
Great. We'll put links to those in the show notes. So that's it. A little bit more from Cranfield Aerospace, I think, in the future. We want to come back and monitor this. We want to see how you're getting on. We want to hold your toes to the fire for all our youngsters in the future. But such an exciting project. So thanks very much for spending the time with us today, Scott.
Thanks, Peter. Really nice to have you up.
So we're back in the office. We'd like to thank White Hearts as well as the wider extended family of supporters, including Mick Oakey at The Aviation Historian. You can find me at Nascot Hornet on Twitter, and you can find Tim, Gareth and Ellie on the extended Twitter, Facebook and Instagram feeds. And that's it from Cranfield with the arrival of the music. It's goodbye from Scott.
Thanks, Peter. Good to see you again.
And it's goodbye from me, Peter Johnson. Remember, stay tuned to this frequency. That is, of course, Aerospace Radio Station Extended. Our legal policy and use of our material can be found on our website. Please do ask before using anything you hear. The program's produced with a Creative Commons license.
Please leave us a review wherever you play your podcast. It genuinely helps grow our program and broaden its reach. You can also review the program and leave us feedback on our Facebook page. We'd love to hear from you. If you want to email us, our email address is getinvolved@aviationextended.co.uk. And remember, there's no E at the beginning of extended.
Extend it.
This is XTP Media.